Network. Or ask your smart speaker to play Radio Catskill.
Live from the WJFF studios in Liberty, New York, this is Radio Catskill. I'm Tim Bruno. On today's show, the latest twist in New York's congestion pricing saga. Former President Donald Trump plans to kill congestion pricing if reelected, and Governor Hochul's pause could let him. That's according to New York Focus, the independent nonprofit newsroom. We'll learn about the three ways a Trump administration could try to stop the transit funding toll. The Emerging Anglers event at the Catskill Fly Fishing Center and Museum is this Saturday, celebrating the museum's renewed vision. What is it? We'll find out from the Catskill Fly Fishing Museum Executive Director, Ali Abate. And Ambient Barn, the locally produced show on Radio Catskill that explores the tonally fascinating and expansive world of electronic music, is moving to a new time. We'll speak to Mark Partridge. And Classical Kit is here. First, the news.
Live from NPR News, I'm Korva Coleman. In Israel, protests have followed news that Hamas recently killed six hostages. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has faced calls to resign and to immediately sign a ceasefire with Hamas to free the remaining hostages. He says his goal is the destruction of Hamas. NPR's Hadil Alshelchi says one of his critics was formerly aligned with Netanyahu, former Israeli General Benny Gantz.
Last night, Gantz came out fighting. He demanded Netanyahu make a deal or quit. Gantz is the leader of the centrist National Unity Party, and he was part of Israel's emergency war cabinet that was formed after October 7th. But then he quit in June, protesting Netanyahu's handling of the war. Last night, he said Netanyahu should, quote, hand over the keys and go home.
NPR's Hadil Alshelchi reporting. The Justice Department has announced terrorism charges against six Hamas leaders, three of whom are dead. They're being accused of conspiracy to murder Americans as part of Hamas's attack on Israel last October. It's believed at least 43 Americans were killed. The city of Lviv in western Ukraine came under Russian missile and drone attack this morning. NPR's Hanna Palomarenko reports from Kyiv at least seven people were killed.
Lviv is close to the Polish border, and the city is recovering from the attack, which hit schools, hospitals, and other infrastructure. In this video by Ukraine's emergency services, rescue workers carry the body of a dead child from the rubble of one building. Her sister and mother were also killed. Only her father survived. Lviv mayor Andrei Sadovy posted an image of the distraught man with his face covered in blood. Sadovy said this was a very massive attack and a lot of places were damaged. The strike comes a day after more than 50 were killed by missile hits on a military academy in central eastern Ukraine. Hanna Polomarenko, NPR News, Kyiv.
Stocks open mixed this morning after yesterday's big sell-off. NPR's Scott Horsley reports the Dow Jones Industrial Average rose about 100 points in early trading.
Stock in Dollar Tree is slumping after the discount retailer lowered its sales forecast for the year. Dollar Tree says its cost-conscious customers are getting even more cautious with their spending. A survey of manufacturing managers finds the nation's factory sector is still in a slump, with new orders and output both down in August. Managers blame high borrowing costs along with uncertainty over the upcoming election. Oil prices are falling, with the U.S. benchmark dropping below $70 a barrel. Retail gasoline prices are also down. AAA reports the average price of regular gas nationwide is just under $3.32 a gallon. That's down about a nickel from a week ago and 50 cents lower than this time last year. Scott Horsley, NPR News, Washington.
On Wall Street, the Dow is now up 86 points. It's NPR. Vice President Harris and former President Donald Trump are both campaigning today. Harris goes to New Hampshire. That's where she'll discuss a new tax incentive proposal for new businesses. Trump will hold a recorded town hall in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania. That will be televised later tonight on Fox. The class of drugs that include Wegovy is helping people lose weight, sometimes for the first time ever. But the obesity medications have also prompted reports of suicidal thoughts. NPR's Sydney Lupkin reports a new pair of studies offers some reassurance.
Two studies published in the medical journal JAMA Internal Medicine find that semaglutide, the main ingredient in popular weight loss and diabetes drugs like Wegovy and Ozempic, is not associated with an increased risk of suicide. The research reaffirms findings by the Food and Drug Administration and regulators in Europe. They had investigated a possible link. Still, more research needs to be done. Doctors from the University of Pittsburgh and University of California, San Francisco wrote in an accompanying editorial. The studies didn't tackle how the drugs affect people with existing mental health conditions like depression. And they didn't include tirzepatide, the main ingredient in similar drugs Zepbound and Mounjaro. Sydney Lepkin, NPR News.
The semifinals men's match has been set at the U.S. Open tennis tournament, and for the first time since 2005, it will feature All-Americans. Taylor Fritz will meet Francis Tiafoe on Friday for the ability to advance to the U.S. Open final. Whoever wins will become the first American man to advance to the final since 2009. This is NPR.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include BritBox, working to help people discover British dramas and mysteries, including The Responder, starring Martin Freeman, and entire series like Sherlock and Vera. Streaming at BritBox.com/NPR.
Welcome back to Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. More developments in New York's congestion pricing plan. New York-focused senior reporter Sam Mellons recently investigated former President Donald Trump's plan to kill congestion pricing if reelected. Mellons writes, Donald Trump has made no secret of his plans for New York's congestion pricing program. In a social media post in May, the Republican presidential candidate promised he would, quote, terminate, all caps, congestion pricing in my, all caps, first week back in office, end quote. Trump doesn't always deliver on his promises, but he could make good on this one. If he's elected in November, there are at least three ways, Mellon says, he could kill the program or hold it up for years. Does Governor Kathy Hochul have a plan to stop him? Let's ask New York Focus senior reporter Sam Mellons. We regularly partner with New York Focus to bring you their in-depth investigative reporting. Sam, good morning.
Good morning, Tim. How are you doing?
Well, good. So here's another twist in the congestion pricing saga. Let's remind folks about why Governor Kathy Hochul paused the congestion pricing program and, you know, what could happen, as we were saying here, because of this pause.
So Governor Hochul paused the program in June, a few weeks before it was supposed to start, saying the cost of living is too high. This would represent another cost on, you know, the subset of working New Yorkers who drive to downtown Manhattan, and we can't afford that right now. That was her justification. The consequences of this, if it remains in place, are that congestion pricing was slated to provide $1 billion a year to the MTA for needed repairs and upgrades to the subway and commuter rail systems, you know, things like adding elevators for accessibility, updating signals to make the trains move faster, and so on. And without that money, those projects are all in danger.
And she is now being challenged by two lawsuits. But speaking at the Democratic National Convention last week, she said she wants to unveil a replacement around the new year. Is that going to be too late?
It might be. I mean, it depends on large part in what happens in the November election. I think if Kamala Harris is elected president, the Biden administration has been friendly to congestion pricing, and I think we can expect that a Kamala Harris administration would be as well. But if Trump is elected president, and as far as I know, it's a roughly even shot right now, more or less a coin flip, then, you know, as you said, we know what he wants to do with the congestion pricing program, and there's a few ways that he could try to do it.
Yeah, let's talk about some of those ways. There are at least three ways you write in your article at nysfocus.com about that. The first one, refusing to sign the document authorizing the program.
Right. So congestion pricing, it needs approval from the state, and because it's a program that operates on federal roads, it also needs approval from the federal government. There's a document that the representative of the federal Department of Transportation needs to sign. The Biden Department of Transportation has said that they're not going to sign before New York does. And if New York's representative still hasn't signed by the time a theoretical Trump administration takes office, it seems pretty likely that Trump would just order his Department of Transportation not to sign the document, meaning that the program can't take effect.
And one of the lawsuits we mentioned against the Hochul administration is tied up in this signature portion of the way that congestion pricing could take effect. Can you explain a little bit about that?
Yeah, I can. So what the lawsuit is arguing is they're saying the congestion pricing was created by a 2019 law that the legislature passed, and the implementation is really up to the MTA, which is, you know, a semi-independent, state body that's distinct from the governor's administration. And it was structured that way to insulate them from political influence. And so the lawsuit is saying the MTA has the job of implementing the program, and the governor's administration signs off, but that's just a formality. The governor doesn't actually have the authority to say, no, I am not going to sign this, because the law doesn't give her the authority to implement or not implement the program. So they're saying to the judge that he should order the governor's administration to sign the document because they don't have the authority not to, they claim.
And if the Trump administration were in power, you've talked to some folks who could say they easily could see the Federal Department of Transportation withholding its signature, so congestion pricing would not start.
Yeah, that's right. This lawsuit is based on state law and what state law requires, but you know, the federal government is a whole different matter, and I think there's less control over what they do or don't do.
Another way that a second Trump administration could try to kill the congestion pricing program is by deploying one of Trump's tactics of delay, 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 but in a different way. To talk about number two, demanding a more detailed environmental study, but then delaying it.
Yeah, so the congestion pricing program, there was an environmental study before it was designed, before it was implemented, to determine what it would do and, you know, different ways to set the program up and what those different ways would do to the environment and whether it would harm the environment. And it produced, you know, hundreds of pages long study with appendixes that were hundreds more pages, even thousands of pages long. And the federal government determined, no, this will not harm the environment. It can go forward. Amazingly enough, this, you know, tome-length study was actually the short version, an environmental assessment of a process that can be even longer when the government does what's called an environmental impact statement. So theoretically, a Trump administration could say, this environmental assessment, it's really not good enough. We need a full environmental impact statement, which could easily take years. And then even once it's done, it still needs to be approved by the federal government, and they can just not approve it. That's something that presidents of both parties have done to delay projects that they don't like. So that's another tool in the toolbox.
And Trump's done this before. The Gateway train tunnel under the Hudson River was a recent example.
Right. So this is the tunnel that's supposed to allow for more train capacity to run trains between New York and New Jersey and supplement the current tunnel, which is, you know, some 100 years old. It's been, you know, an apple in the eye of urban planners for decades, I think. And under Trump, the environmental study for this project was completed in May 2018. And then he and his administration just sat on it. You know, the Democratic senators and congressmen from New York and New Jersey were saying, hey, can you please approve this study? It's ready to go. It's just waiting. And he left office without approving it. It wasn't approved until May 2021, 3 years after it was completed once Biden had taken office.
If you're just joining us, we're speaking to Sam Mellins from New York Focus about the proposed plans by a second Trump administration to kill congestion pricing and how Governor Kathy Hochul's pause could potentially let him do that. We're talking about the three ways the Trump administration could try to stop the transit funding toll. Let's talk about that third one, which is switching sides in a lawsuit seeking to kill the program. The state of New Jersey currently suing the federal government in an attempt to delay congestion pricing. So what would that do? How would that work?
Yeah, I'll explain that. I just want to quickly specify, these are not proposals that, you know, the Trump administration or the Trump campaign have put forward. Trump has said he wants to terminate congestion pricing, but he hasn't sort of specifically outlined a way to do that. You know, often detailed policy visions aren't exactly his thing.
Yeah.
So these are all things that are possible within, or potentially possible within, the confines of federal law. So that's
correct. Yeah. Thank you for clarifying that. He has said publicly that he would terminate congestion pricing in his first week back in office. You, in your article with New York Focus, are outlining some of the ways that they could try to kill the program. So thank you for clarifying that. And so talk about the switching sides and a lawsuit possibility.
Right. So this is related to the previous one about demanding a more thorough environmental study. New Jersey is currently suing the New York and the MTA in federal court, and they're saying that the environmental study didn't have enough focus on New Jersey and what effect this program will have on New Jersey. And they're asking for a more extensive environmental study, that so-called environmental impact statement rather than the shorter environmental assessment. And the federal government, the Department of Justice, you know, the lawyers for the government, are opposing this lawsuit under Biden, and they're defending congestion pricing in court and arguing that the environmental study was adequate. But the federal government, the Department of Justice answers to the president. And so if Trump takes office, he can say, you know what, we're not fighting this lawsuit anymore. New Jersey, how about we settle this lawsuit? And actually, we agree with you that we need the more extensive environmental study. So let's just drop this whole thing and we'll go back and do the study and see you in a few years, which is often how long these kinds of things take. So that wouldn't kill the program, but it would certainly substantially delay it.
And we mentioned that, you know, Governor Kathy Hochul paused this. She's indicating or telegraphing that she might want to consider resurrecting it, but not until after the first of the year, definitely after the election. So we'll see what happens. There's not much, though, that could be done prior to the election or even before the end of the year, is there?
Done in terms of what?
In terms of resurrecting it.
Well, the governor, so right now the legislature isn't in session. You know, they take a break from June to the end of the year and do work in their own district.
And they're back in January.
Right, until January when they come back. The governor can call them into special session at any time. So if she had a change of heart and decided actually this program should start, or even if she had an alternate proposal to present, like with a different toll or something, she can call the legislature back into session to vote on that. But I should say, if she wanted to start the program, she doesn't need the legislature for that. What's preventing the program from starting is that her Department of Transportation hasn't signed the approval for it to start. So she could pick up the phone right now and call the Department of Transportation and say, actually, it's a go, sign the form. Then the federal government signs the form. And the cameras are in place. So the program, you know, I don't want to say it could start tomorrow necessarily, but it could be started in relatively short order if she wanted to.
It was all geared to start earlier this summer. What's the likelihood, though, do you think, of her picking up that phone before November 5th?
She said that she wants to wait until around the new year. I have no reason to doubt the sincerity of that statement. I think she is hoping that, you know, there'll be some political advantage to waiting until after the election to really sort of pick this up again. I don't know whether or not that's true. I know some Republicans are running ads, you know, either praising themselves for killing congestion pricing or warning that it'll come back unless Republicans win. So that might be an effective tactic. But anyway, I think I don't see any reason to doubt her when she says around the new year is when she wants to pick this back up again.
A lot of stakes in this election. This is just one of them. Since her abrupt decision to put that congestion pricing plan on hold, you've been all over this story. Last month, we actually talked to you about how she says she's working with the legislature to replace the congestion pricing plan, but legislators hadn't really heard of anything or any conversations. Are you aware of any other developments between her administration and legislators, or any other movement on how to fill that $15 billion hole in the MTA's budget?
I am personally not. There has been some reporting that there are conversations happening at a very high level. I have not talked to people familiar with those conversations. But, you know, $15 billion, that's a lot of money for New York State. And it doesn't come out of nowhere. And Phil, how to make up that gap is a serious question. I mean, even, you know, congestion pricing could come back at a lower level, and then you only need $5 billion instead of $15 billion from somewhere else or something like that. But even so, it's a lot of money. It's a serious question. It requires serious proposals and serious consideration. And if that has been happening at all, it's been happening, you know, completely behind closed doors.
Is public opposition still unfavorable there for congestion pricing?
To tell the truth, I haven't seen any recent sort of opinion polling or anything on that. I know around the time that it was paused, there was some opinion polling saying it was pretty widely disliked by New York voters. You know, supporters of the programs argue that it's most hated before it's implemented, when people are expecting to pay the tolls but don't yet have a clear sense of the benefits, and that public perception of it has improved after implementation in places like London and Singapore that use it. So it remains to be seen whether that's an effect that would be replicated in New York.
All right, Sam Mellins from New York Focus on the congestion pricing plans in New York State, New York City. And today we're talking about how a potential Trump administration could kill it and how Governor Kathy Hochul's policy might allow that, depending on what happens in November. You can read Sam's reporting at nysfocus.com. Sam, thank you so much for joining us, and we'll be talking to you soon, I'm sure.
Thanks, Tim. Great to chat.
Right, we'll take a break, and when we come back, the Emerging Anglers celebration at the Catskill Fly Fishing Museum that's coming up Saturday. We'll learn more. This is Radio Chatskill.
Before they were arrested, Pussy Riot's Nadia Tolokonikva remembers what they sang.
Our last performance before being thrown to jail was Virgin Mary, Please Become a Feminist. Virgin Mary, Please Get Rid of Putin.
Ideas about being a loudmouth. That's next time on the TED Radio Hour from NPR.
Friday afternoon at 1 on Radio Catskill.
Radio Catskill, keeping New York voters connected this election season. October 26th is the last day to register to vote for the general election in New York State. Applications must be submitted in person, online, or by mail no later than October 26th. Election Day is November 5th. In-person early voting takes place in the 9 days prior to Election Day. And in New York, any registered voter may apply for a mail-in ballot. Radio Catskill, keeping you connected this election season.
Radio Catskill is partnering with StoryCorps for One Small Step, matching strangers with different political beliefs to just have a conversation about their lives. Hi, I'm Judy Balaban, and I'm working on One Small Step at Radio Catskill. Help bring our community together, one conversation at a time. Go to WJFFradio.org and click on the One Small Step logo to join us.
StoryCorps' One Small Step and the radio station hubs are made possible by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
Welcome back to Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. We're having a little trouble reaching Ali Abate at the Catskill Fly Fishing Museum. We'll pivot to another story and get her on after we learn more about Ambient Barn, a show here on Radio Catskill from music producer, sound designer, and filmmaker Mark Partridge. He curates an hour of electronic music in its many forms in his big red barn here in the Catskills. That's every week. And he's moving to a new time slot. We'll learn more in his conversation with Jason Dole.
And now joining us here in the studio, it's Mark Partridge, host of Ambient Barn here on Radio Catskill, which is moving to a new time. It's now going to be on Friday nights at midnight, right after the Deep End, starting this very Friday night. Mark, welcome to the studio.
Hey, Jason. How you doing? Happy to be here.
Good, good. It's good to have you here in person.
Yeah, I know.
You want to talk about where you usually record your show?
Yeah, so I live in Jeffersonville, and I have a big red barn in my backyard, and we do most of our all, not even we, well, not even we, me. I do all of the recordings in there. So, yeah, it's a fun place to record a show for sure. I like your Kraftwerk t-shirt. I just noticed that.
Oh, I like your Moog's shirt, too.
Oh, we're very on
electronic
brand.
Bros today talking about electronic music.
That's right.
But that's where the name comes from, right? Ambient Barns,
because
you're out in your barn.
Yep, I'm in my barn, and I play. I'm a producer and a musician myself, so I make ambient music as part of sort of my repertoire. I make it in my barn. Open the door, I can check out the deer in the field, got the chickens around. It's peaceful. It's wonderful, actually.
And you, for the show that had been on Sunday nights, yep. late night, now it's going to be on Friday night, still late night, mm-hmm. But a cooler night, as you said.
Yeah.
And, for that, like, what do you do? You kind of like do deep dives into different subgenres, kind of, right?
Yeah. I mean, that's kind of, the guiding principle is each week is sort of a unique curation of music. So sometimes it'll be genre focused. Sometimes we'll do, I think we just did an episode on dark synth. We've done episodes on IDM and Detroit techno. But I also like to do deep dives into specific artists. So I know we just did a back-to-back with two Boards of Canada remixes, or not remixes, two Boards of Canada mixes, hour-long mixes that were done sort of live performances. And sometimes, I'll do a show based on like a synthesizer that like all of these different types of bands or artists used. So, it's whatever I'm feeling that week. When I can get ahead of it, it's better because, you can do a couple in a row and it's what it is. It's just I love listening to electronic music. I feel like it's endless in the amount of variety that there is, and in the amount of subgenres. So it's a good time.
So what does it mean to you, like, to you're exploring the music as, as a DJ, you're curating, you're presenting other people's work, but you're coming to it as somebody who creates this music too?
Yeah, for sure. And actually, part of my creative practice has always been listening to a ton of music. I find so much inspiration in just listening to what other people are doing. And, when an artist can sort of conjure a vibe that is uniquely theirs, I find a lot of inspiration in that. So this show actually is part of my creative process. It's just become that for me. It's become like my weekly ritual of like, all right, what are we doing this week? And how is this going to influence whatever I'm making this week?
Right. Like, you can't be a writer unless you're reading. Like, you can't be a musician unless you're listening to music. All right. Musicians are doing it. You're like just inviting the public in on your listening session almost.
Yeah, exactly. And the show has kind of, it's almost become like a practice for me, like something that is just what I do as part of building out and trying to expand my own creative palette, as it were.
You also do music, performance and workshops like in the community. I know that you've been doing like workshops over at Bethel Woods. Mm-hmm. You want to talk a little bit about like the sorts of things you do? Then we'll talk about what you got coming up.
Yeah, sure. So I just wrapped on Tuesday, actually, this past week. I do a synthesizer sound bath called Bliss Waves, which been doing since about early this year. Did our first one at Bethel. It went really well. We've done a couple since. And the idea is, sound baths, usually they're very kind of yogi with, bowls and gongs and things like that. And I am not a yoga person, but I am a musician. So I think that there is sound is very powerful, especially in the context of meditation and the context of like inner journeys. So Bliss Waves is a sound bath that I've been doing for a few months, the better part of this year. And it's a synthesizer sound bath. And it's been a really fun thing to do, a really cool way to approach wellness, and a really interesting take, I think, on the sound bath. So I do that. I also play live. So I have a couple of shows coming up on Saturday, September 7th at the Old Foundation. We're throwing a party called Foundation of Funk. And it's a dance party. I have, I'll be playing, kicking off with a set around 10. And then we have, Cat Silk and Uma DJ are going to be coming in and just ripping it up. They're amazing DJs. It's a mother-daughter duo. So if you're in the Jeffersonville area, or if you are looking for some fun dance party to do on Saturday, please come out 9:30 p.m. And then Wednesday, the following Wednesday, September 11th, I'm playing at Bethel Woods at the Horizon Happy Hour at their Market Sheds. And I think that kicks off around 6. And those parties are really fun. They do them in the Market Sheds. It's outside. They have cocktails and food, and it's a good time. You should come out.
Music in the community, bringing the community together. And,
that's right.
And then also healing the community. That sound bad. Like I've known people that do like those gong sessions and things like that. And I was wondering if it's like that with a synthesizer, and it is. So that's pretty cool.
Yeah. Yeah. We have, sometimes I'll do them with a local yoga teacher. And she'll bring like kind of guided meditation into it, and she brings her sound bowls and her gongs, and then it kind of becomes more of a hybrid, you know, kind of a bridge between the two. And then when I do it on my own, it's synthesizers and it's live ambient music. But it's a lot of fun. If you see them around, if you see Bliss Waves around, take the opportunity to, come and join us.
You'll be doing it again sometime.
Yeah, we're doing it again. Yeah. We don't have anything on the books yet, but will soon.
We'll keep an eye out for it. And again, you're performing at the Foundation on Saturday and the Horizon Stage.
It's Horizon Happy Hour. It's not on the Horizon Stage. It's at the Market Shed.
At the Market Shed.
But it's near. It's right across from there. Yeah.
It's adjacent to the stage. When's
it
that?
It is. Wednesday, September 11th at 6 p.m.
Next Wednesday. All right. Yep. Well, and then, of course, the big news is the Ambient Barn. Friday nights at midnight from here on out, starting this Friday, and congrats, and also happy birthday.
Thank you. Yeah, it's the show's actually starting. It's moving to Friday on my birthday, which is really fun.
It's great.
Yeah, serendipity.
Mark, thanks so much for coming out.
Thanks, Jason.
Yeah, happy birthday to Mark, and happy birthday to us, because we get to hear that show as part of our local music lineup on Fridays. That's starting this Friday at 7 a.m. all the way through Mark's Ambient Barn show, starting at midnight. That goes until 1. It's from 7 p.m. to 1 a.m. All locally produced music shows here on Radio Catskill. Check it out starting this Friday. We'll take a break. When we come back, the Emerging Anglers fundraiser at the Catskill Fly Fishing Museum. This is Radio Catskill.
Support for Radio Catskill comes from Jeff Works Office Solutions, located right on Main Street in Jeffersonville, New York. A newly renovated pet-friendly office space that rents by the day, week, or month, with hot desks, sound-insulated rooms, Wi-Fi, modern amenities, and 24-hour secure access. Online at jeffworksjayville.com. And from The Cooperage Project, thecooperageproject.org. And listeners like you who donate at wjffradio.org.
Join us for Radio Catskill's 2024 Community Awards, September 12th, honoring individuals dedicated to environmental stewardship and sustainability, including Lori Ramey of the Upper Delaware Council and Lisa Lyons of Morgan Outdoors. Celebrate their hard work and commitment to healthier and more sustainable local communities at the 2024 Radio Catskill Community Awards, September 12th at La Sagone, Narrowsburg. Get your tickets now at wjffradio.org.
This is Radio Catskill. I'm Tim Bruno. The birthplace of dry fly fishing in America is, of course, right here in the Catskills. The Catskill Fly Fishing Center and Museum is celebrating with their Emerging Anglers event this Saturday. They're also celebrating a refocusing of their vision. Joining us now with more is Ali Abate, Executive Director at the Catskill Fly Fishing Center and Museum. Good morning.
Good morning, Tim. Thank you for having me.
Well, thanks for being here. And I mentioned that you are also not only focusing, you know, dry fly fishing and fly fishing at your event, the Emerging Anglers event this Saturday, but a refocusing of your vision. What is this renewed vision?
Sure. And Emerging Anglers is actually not this Saturday. It's the following Saturday, September 14th.
I have no sense of date, time, and space. Yes, you're right. Today's the 4th, and for some reason I got those things mixed up. It's September 14th.
Exactly.
I apologize. Yes.
Correct. So what we've really been working on, I think what we're known for certainly is preserving the arts and culture of fly fishing. And obviously that is a huge part of what we do. But we've really been kind of realigning to connect as much as we possibly can with our local youth, our schools, and really the next generation of folks that will come up to support our region, our community, our area, and become anglers, become children and people who love nature and love our region, and are really invested in continuing to care for this place and the space that we all love so much. So we have a lot of programming that's been focusing on working with our local students to bring them onto our campus for a free after-school program. And we've also been opening our doors up to scout groups, Girl Scouts, Boy Scouts, as well as field trip programming for schools in the region.
It's great that you're getting youth involved to experience this. And also you talk about the transformative power of fly fishing. What does that transformative power feel like?
Sure. I think anyone that spends a little time, you know, sitting near a river, standing in a river, can kind of get a sense of what we're talking about and what happens when we see kids get fly rods in their hands or tie flies or do anything that's really involved with the sport and with the arts of the sport, is that it allows this opportunity to kind of step away from day-to-day life, from phones, from screens, from any other distractions or conflicts that might be going on around us, and connecting in nature in a really kind of, you know, present way, which is just so difficult in this day and age to get an opportunity to do. And being able to teach that to children and have them have it as a practice in their life is something that just has so many benefits in terms of physical and mental health, and something that we see and we know it happens when we have kids and adults learning and participating in fly fishing in our space. And it's just something we want to be able to share with others and have people know about how truly powerful it really is.
I like that you mentioned that it's a practice, because there's something so, I think, centering and a sense of solitude, connection to nature, mm-hmm. connection to the river, mm-hmm. connection to your flies by doing this. And to focus on youth who are so distracted by so many things coming at them through various screens, that's a really kind of big thing to teach and to get them to learn and love.
Right, exactly. And I think it's a unique way to do it, but it's really connecting with something that anyone could learn how to do, but really giving them the opportunity to do that when it's not always, you know, the most accessible thing to pick up a fly rod or understand what dry flies even are. So it allows us a way to teach that and get kids really excited about it, but then also have these additional benefits that are really, as we've said, so powerful, so transformative. And what we've also seen is that a lot of our kids express after going through the program not only that they want to do it again, but that they want to teach it to others. And I think that sort of giving back, giving forward is really, you know, just another element of how it's a very powerful thing.
You've partnered with Sullivan West Central School District to bring fly fishing to local school communities. And David Eggleton, the principal at Sullivan West, is going to be speaking at the Emerging Anglers event September 14th, next Saturday. And tell us a little bit about that partnership and how that's been working for you.
Sure. So when I got started about 2 years ago, I really wanted to connect with our local schools and find kind of the best ways to determine what their needs were, you know, not what we wanted to do with them, but what they really needed from us as a community cultural organization. And what that really started to look like was reinvigorating the Trout in the Classroom programs. And Dave Eggleton at the time was at Livingston Manor and also assisting with Roscoe Schools. He's now just at Sullivan West. And we were able, through grant funding that we applied for and received, to help both Livingston Manor and Roscoe Central Schools get the equipment and the curriculum they needed to reinvigorate their Trout in the Classroom program, which is an incredible STEM and STEAM program that allows kids to raise trout from eggs in tanks in school. And then because we're in this amazing river region, all of those schools are able to just go right outside and release those trout into rivers on their campuses of their schools. So it really gives kids a sense of learning the life cycle of this animal, understanding how important trout are to our rivers and streams, and having a direct connection to that from as young as, you know, 5 or 6 years old to up through high school. And we participated in the trout release programs with those schools this year, providing activities, helping them release their trout into the river, and really just connecting with them in a way that, you know, gets them in the classroom, but both out of the classroom, and a connection to fly fishing as well.
We recently replayed Rosie Starr's reporter audio postcard from this past spring's trout release with the Sullivan West students. And mm-hmm. it was, again, just hearing it, the joy of it was so great. It was one of our favorite segments. That's why we had an encore.
Yeah, it really was a joyful event. And in another way to kind of take all of these interdisciplinary things and bring them together, because there's elements of science, there's art, there's a hands-on learning component. And then, they're getting a chance to be outdoors and really enjoy that in a safe way and, in, again, a way that gets them away from screens, which is something I think we all wish we had more time to do.
So at the Emerging Anglers event, September 14th, you're going to be promoting fly fishing culture and river conservation, of course. There will be cocktails. Tell folks about what they can expect on September 14th at the Emerging Anglers event.
Yeah, so this particular event, it's in its seventh year, but it's the first time we're hosting it on our very campus. And we're on 50 acres. Yes, right on the Willowemoc. And we're excited about that because we do, if you have not visited before, we encourage you to come. And certainly this event would be a great way to get introduced to our space. So we'll be beside our pond, which is just off the Willowemoc Creek, for the cocktail hour, which will include cocktails and beverages donated by a host of amazing sponsors, including the Catskill Brewery, Pollinator Spirits, Northern Farmhouse Pasta, Foster Supply Hospitality, and also 52 Wine and Liquor. And so they're providing beverages, and then the Neversink General Store will be catering the evening, which includes hors d'oeuvres and then kind of building up to a dinner followed by dessert. And we're really building in as much time as possible for people to socialize and enjoy one another and have little tidbits of opportunities to learn about the programming that we're doing and why it is so important to fundraise for us and to help support what we're trying to do so that we can not only continue it, but hopefully see it grow over time.
Also, you're going to have something that sounds really interesting. Explain this, live painting?
Yeah, so Steven Weinberg is a Catskill-based artist and author. He has a couple of incredible books and does these beautiful, beautiful paintings of brook trout, among other types of fish. And he's going to be, and he's great to work with too, because he's collaborative and very creative and very kind of go with the flow. So we're going to set him up alongside the pond as the plan to have him painting as people are having cocktails and enjoying and getting a chance to see what his process is, how beautiful it is. And then hopefully also create some beautiful pieces of artwork that we will potentially auction off or do something fun with during the course of the night.
That sounds like fun. Again, the Catskill Fly Fishing Museum's Emerging Anglers fundraising event, Saturday, September 14th. You can find more information at cffcm.com. Also, want to remind folks that you're going to be closed this weekend because you've got the Catskill Rodmakers Gathering, right?
That is correct. In its 30th year, the Catskill Rodmakers Gathering brings about 100 folks from all over the country who are rod makers of all ages and all kind of different levels of ability. And they share all sorts of best practices and techniques. They cast a lot of rods. They spend time together. And it's a way that we really get to utilize in a very, I think, both impactful and engaging way, our heritage rod making shop, the workshop that we have on site where we build bamboo rods and we also preserve the heritage of that craft and allow people to see what that really looks like to build something from scratch that started as a piece of bamboo and then comes down to this beautiful fly fishing rod that can then be used to catch fish.
Yeah, preserving the heritage of fly fishing in the Catskills. That's what you're doing. And also educating
That's
the
right.
next generation of anglers and conservationists. Ali Abate, thank you so much for joining us this morning. And have a great event on Saturday, September 14th. More information again, cffcm.com.
Thank you so much, Tim. We look forward to seeing you.
We'll take a break, and when we come back, we've got our special classical kit here, a presentation called Bach to Blues to Jazz on the cello. This is Radio Catskill.
I'm Maria Hinojosa. This week on Latino USA, our award-winning series from 2020, when I traveled to the U.S.-Mexico border, starting in El Paso and then Ciudad Juarez for part one of The Moving Border.
CBP recibe a 10 personas hoy ingresando por la tarde. Nos quedamos en el número 19,428.
That's This Week on Latino USA.
Thursday afternoon at 1 on Radio Catskill.
Hi, this is Jeff, your host on Radio Catskill's Electric Mountain, featuring the very best of global dance music. I play the best of dance music from back in the day to today, and every week I'll feature a guest DJ spinning a continuous set bringing their unique style. Come dance with us on Electric Mountain each and every Saturday night from 12 to 2, exclusively on Radio Catskill.
Welcome back to Radio Chatskill. Classical Kit is here, and she's brought back one of our favorite guests, Alex Prisgintis, for his cello program that's coming up at the Ellenville Public Library this Saturday, the 7th at 1, called From Bach to Blues to Jazz. Classical Kit, good morning. Alex, good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning. Thank you for having me back.
Yeah, so glad you could do that. For listeners who weren't listening last time you were here, you're an author, musician, historian, preservationist, and, you know, because you started as a boy, like, collecting bottles, and then from there went to studying where they came from and all sorts of things. I'd like to say that you started as a collector, but you became a connector. And that's what you do with your music. You take music that people might not associate blues with Bach or jazz with Bach, and you help the listener make connections between them. So, tell us about this program that you have coming up at the Ellenville Public Library.
You know, for one, I don't think I've ever heard that analogy before, and it's one of the best things I've been told, so that's something I'm going to have to use moving forward.
Oh, well, thank you.
Second, so the topic of the Ellenville performance, which is From Bach to Blues to Jazz, for those who are able to attend From Bach to Rock, my program at the Liberty Public Library, the focus of that was showcasing the generations of inspiration that the classical and Baroque works of Johann Sebastian Bach had on more contemporary composers, whether it be in jazz, rock and roll, or even pop from the 20th and 21st centuries. In the realm of Bach to Blues to Jazz, it's a similar concept. I always like to think of Bach as one of the world's earliest jazz artists. He was always improvising. It's even said that during many of the Sunday church services, he would often improvise on the organ. So we explore some of those, you might say, improvisational techniques in both rhythmic forms as well as on notes and tones in the cello suites, preferably the suites of 1, 2, 3, and 4 in G major, D minor, C major, and E flat major, respectively. Each of their preludes has a bit of a different, you might say, introduction that we relate to a developing child. The first suite in G major has a rather jovial atmosphere with these large arpeggiated chords, somewhat similar to a young growing up child. We have the second prelude to the second suite in D minor, which has a more darker tone, somewhat perhaps reminiscent of teenage years for the developing child. With number three, that's in C major, that has a more mature atmosphere, and that, you might say, a mature sense is carried over into number four in E flat major. So with all of those in place, we then like to transition into some of the world's and the nation's great jazz artists. And in particular, we like to focus on the Jazz Ambassadors, which were a group of musicians from the 1950s that traveled behind the Iron Curtain. Among the names included Dizzy Gillespie, we have Benny Goodman, and we also have Dave Brubeck as well, one of my favorites. So some of them incorporated into there, we feature selections like Blue Rondo, A La Turque, Take Five, A Night in Tunisia. And then from there, we look to see some of the inspirations that jazz has on the blues. And that takes some, you might say, some inspiration from those who attended From Bach to Rock at Liberty. You might have noticed some of the elaborate guitar pedals and even the looping station I use in conduction with a more classically based cello. So we'll explore some of those themes with selections from a few pieces, perhaps from the British invasion with bands like the Animals and Led Zeppelin, as well as a few bands from at home that use the blues, such as ZZ Top.
Well, I love that you make that connection, how as Bach moved on, the music became more complex and more mature, but from the earliest to the latest, it's all inspired so many people. And you mentioned Brubeck, and, you know, Brubeck has also composed church music as Bach did.
Yes.
So that's a really interesting choice that you've got Dave Brubeck in there. So how do you wind up choosing which pieces you're going to put in a particular program?
You know, what we like to, as we say, that theme tying history with harmony, which is a branding I use on all of the different cello programs I present, we like to tie historical connections together. So it's not as much just musical connections, but also, you might say, with historical connections as well. So, for instance, with all these, in the case of the, you might say, event here with Bach to blues to jazz. With a lot of my programs, I do enjoy starting with John Coltrane's My Favorite Things. I always feel it has a nice, not only a great jazz standard from the late 1950s, early 1960s, but it always, I feel, situates the audience quite nicely. From here, you might say we go quite chronologically. We explore, very briefly the different preludes from Bach, as discussed before, and their different, you might say, themes and tonalities. We take special note, I should say, on the suite prelude from suite number 2 in D minor, which I've always felt has a more jazzy quality, particularly in its tonal ranges towards the end. And from then, we expand into the jazz classics. Some include So What by Miles Davis. We have Lou Rondo a la Turk from Dave Brubeck, A Night in Tunisia, Take 5. And then we go into some of the blues standards, which then tie in the rock and roll themes as well.
Right. So could you tell us a little bit about how you started with cello? And how, I mean, did you start learning the classical, or did you, as a young person, I'm sure, interested in popular music, kind of
absolutely
go
it's
in the other direction?
A little bit unique. So I am classically trained. In fact, both of my parents were music teachers down in the Munro-Woodbury School District area, and they were my first teachers. For a while during that time, I consider music for myself more of an escape, if not perhaps even a therapy, than something more of a passion. A little bit about me. I am on the I'm on the autism spectrum disorder, you might say. I was what was formerly known as Asperger's. So music has always been, you might say, something uplifting, something to, you might say, escape from the, you might say, volatile qualities of day-to-day activities. So I was classically trained for, I would say, most of the first 7 to 10 years of my training on the cello. About, I'd say, in my later high school years, I acquired the first piece of equipment, which was the looping station, which was really revolutionary at that time for my development as a cellist because it allowed me to really expand the range of what I could perform from just as a soloist to essentially importing the qualities of a one-man band. In fact, the first piece I used on the looping station, which those of you who attended the Liberty performance would have heard, was Astor Piazzolla's Liber Tango. It really sits well as a piece that can be recorded quite literally as a one-man band, recording 8 different parts live on that looping station in front of an audience, with the exception of the drums. And using that looping station, that allowed me to, you might say, evolve and develop into other genres, whether it be jazz or rock and roll or Irish music or Broadway selections. And with those different elements, you might say, we added the guitar pedals to further expand the sound. So pedals like the delay pedal or the distortion pedal or even the wah-wah pedal, indicative of 1960s and 1970s electric guitars. So it was a development over a period, expanding on the musical ranges, but I am trained classically, and that classical music always does remain, as you might say, a foothold in my experience.
Well, I would also say, you know, Alex, I mean, I was actually a teacher. And most of my career, I worked with persons who were on the spectrum. And I'm thinking about the fact that you started with something that you could do by yourself, and then you managed to kind of multiply yourself so that you were playing in an ensemble situation. But then you took that out of that solitary thing and let it connect you to diverse audiences where you're with a lot of people. And I'm wondering if emotionally, if that was kind of a progression for you also.
It was definitely a progression. And I'd actually like to note it was progression on one particular facet. As I said before, a lot of, you might say, my development in this program has been connecting history with harmony, which involves a dialogue with the audience. Public speaking is actually not one of my weak points. As mentioned before, another one of my facets to my work is lecturing on local history. Between that and these performances, I'm on the road about 160 times each year. However, it is difficult for me to multitask, as I should say. And with that, I'm very thankful to have a great relationship with my father, who not only acts as a mentor, but also, you might say, my manager. And during the, you might say, the performances in that theme of history, we often work at dialogue. We develop scripts together, and that's how we portray history with the audience. So in your, you might say, discussion of evolving within the realms of these performances. We have certainly done that as we look to share history through these dialogues, really making it combining the elements of a historical lecture with the actual concert itself. It really provides an immersive experience for the audience.
Well, I was there for your performance in Liberty, and I enjoyed it very much, so I can attest to that.
I'm so glad you enjoyed it. Thank you.
Well, you're welcome. And, you know, that partnership with your father worked really seamlessly. It was wonderful. Just to make sure that our audience knows all the information, this next concert will be at the Ellenville Public Library and Museum. That's at 40 Center Street in Ellenville. If you need information from them, you can call them at 845-647-5530 or go to eplm.org, and that will be on September 7th from 1 to 3. So a really nice way to spend an afternoon. You know, I love that this is happening in September. You know, there's a wealth of music up here in the summer, and then it kind of like falls off. I mean, driving to the station today, I drove past lots of camps and bungalow colonies, and there were no cars. There were turkeys and ducks and chickens. There were all kinds of animals walking around where, you know, a week ago there would have been dozens of people. So we appreciate that you are local and that you are bringing music to us throughout the year.
I'm very appreciative of your continued work in promoting the arts in this region of the Western Catskills. And I do have some more programs that are coming later in the fall and winter in your region, and I'll be sure to share those with you as time goes closer.
Alex, could you give us a little preview? We have about a minute left.
Oh, of course. Well, the one I can think of off the top of my head, another one of my popular programs, which I call Winter Holidays on the Cello, an all-inclusive program of different selections to enjoy during the holiday season. That'll be coming in early December to the Mammocating Library in Wurtsboro, New York. So for those who are looking to perhaps get out of the house during a cold winter day, you can enjoy some cello music during the winter holidays in Wurtsboro.
Well, that sounds lovely, and I want to thank you again for taking the time to speak with us this morning, and I hope that you have a wonderful performance there in Ellenville and that lots of people come and get to enjoy what you bring to us.
Thank you, as always, for your help in advertising my work as well as the work of other artists.
You're very welcome.
Thank you, Alex. And there's more information about Alex, author, musician, historian, and preservationist, at his website, alexprizgintis.com, alexprizgintis.com. Classical Kid, thank you so much for coming in this morning. Appreciate it.
You're very welcome.
I'll let you get back out to see the ducks and turkeys on your way home.
Yes, I will.
That's all for this edition of Radio Chatskill. A reminder that our 2024 Community Awards are coming up next week, Thursday, September 12th. We are honoring those folks in our area who are making outstanding local contributions to environmental stewardship and sustainability. Catskill Mountain Keeper, Damascus Citizens for Sustainability, Delaware Highlands Conservancy, Farm Arts Collective, Seeds of Northeastern Pennsylvania, and Lori Ramey of the Upper Delaware Council and Lisa Lyons of Morgan Outdoors getting some special recognition for their dedication to the environment. There's ticket information at our website, wjffradio.org, and it's being held at the new, relatively new La Cigone restaurant in Narrowsburg. I haven't been yet, so I can't wait to go. Go to our website, wjffradio.org, for ticket information to help us honor these great stewards of the environment in our community at the 2024 Community Awards. I'm Tim Bruno. Thanks for listening.
Radio Catskill supporters include the Sterling Business and Technology Park, located at Exit 17 on Interstate 84 in Northeast Pennsylvania, offering opportunities to locate or expand businesses on property zoned for manufacturing and other uses. More information at sterlingbusinesspark.com. And listeners like you, who donate at wjffradio.org.
Hi, this is Marco Werman, host of The World. Weekdays at 3, our newsroom connects you with events around the globe. Our reporters in the Americas, Africa, Europe, and Asia get to the heart of the day's news. We bring you international perspectives on issues worldwide and here in the U.S. It's 1 hour each day that broadens horizons and takes you beyond our borders. Join me on The World, afternoons at 3, on Radio Catskill.
Radio Catskill is partnering with StoryCorps for One Small Step, matching strangers with different political beliefs to just have a conversation. Go to WJFFradio.org and click on the One Small Step logo to join us.
WJFF Jeffersonville, streaming live at WJFFradio.org. This is Radio Catskill, local news, culture, and NPR. Today's weather, another sunny day, high 74. Tonight, mainly clear. Some areas of fog from late tonight to tomorrow morning affecting the area. Tonight's low 50. Tomorrow, mostly sunny. Mostly sunny tomorrow and a high 74 again. And for Friday, pleasant sun, clouds 73.